This is Night Call, nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight is the drug industry taking you for a ride with guest Chief Counsel to the House Committee on Intergovernmental Affairs, Mr. Donald Gray. Night Call is an open forum. Speak for yourself. Ask your own questions. Call Night Call Collect from anywhere in North America. From the East and Midwest, call 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. This year, Americans will spend billions of dollars on prescription drugs and on non-prescription drugs. Well, the question looms, are we paying too much for those drugs? Are we being encouraged by druggists and doctors to use more than we really need? And how safe are the drugs that we are asked to buy and to use? Are there others as dangerous as thalidomide, which caused hideously deformed babies when expecting mothers used the drugs? Now, the money and health of almost every American are at stake right now in these questions. So what can be done and how good are the drugs? For instance, there's a drug called Penabla, which the National Academy of Sciences has condemned as having no place in rational therapeutics. Yet it's one of the 200 drugs most often prescribed, with sales totaling some $16 billion a year, or $1 million a year, rather. So how does this happen? Well, tonight we hopefully we'll be able to find out from Mr. W. Donald Gray, who's a senior investigator for the House Subcommittee investigating the food and drug problem. And hopefully, and yes, hopefully, that the Night Call listeners will be responding tonight, and we'd like to find out how you feel about the payment for drugs. Are you overpaying for your drugs, and what can you do about it? Mr. Gray, good evening, sir.
How are you, Del?
Fine, thank you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. I looked over a list of some previous guests, and I appear to be in rather distinguished company.
Well, we thank you for being with us, sir. Mr. Gray, let's begin our Night Call conversation by asking first, how much does the American public know about the drugs that are being purchased and being prescribed for them?
Well, I think the public knows relatively little. In the area of prescription drugs, the purchase of the drug typically receives a bottle from the pharmacy which has his physician's name and his own name and the dosage instructions, and that's about all he knows about it. Normally, he will not know what the drug is. In the case of over-the-counter drugs, he will know the indications on the package and what he hears in the advertising, and that's about it.
Can we assume that our physicians know a little bit more about the drugs?
Well, I think they know more, but there are indications in some areas that they perhaps are not able to keep up with this area, which changes rather rapidly. As well as they should in order to prescribe rationally for their patients. One example that has been discussed quite a bit in our subcommittee, other committees, and in the press is drug chloramycetin, which is a very powerful antibiotic that is effective against a number of different kinds of infecting organisms, but has some very serious side effects. Blood disorders, sometimes fatal, and has been restricted in its official labeling by the Food and Drug Administration now to very few and very serious disorders, and yet it continues to be described very, very widely, and experts recently testifying before the Congress indicated that perhaps as much as 90% of the prescribing of these drugs for non-indicated conditions.
Well, the American public is dependent upon the integrity as well as the professionalism of the physician and the pharmacist, and yet we find that there is a great deal of concern about the profits that are made from the drugs, the fact that we seem to be spending more for drugs than what we should be spending. There's an investigation, or there has been an investigation of the drug industry. Now, first, I'd like to kind of establish the premise. is the American public wrong in depending upon the professionalism of the physician and the pharmacist? And are we at a point that we are questioning the integrity of these people?
Well, I think that the public has to depend on the physician in prescription drugs. This is the only area which I'm aware in which the consumer does not order the product, and the person who orders the product, the physician, does not pay for it. So we have to depend on physicians. Patients cannot prescribe for themselves. They're not competent to prescribe for themselves, so you have to depend on them. Now, what we hope is that there is the Food and Drug Administration, and it has a responsibility given to it by the Congress to assure, insofar as possible, that the drugs that are put at the physician's disposal are both safe and effective for their intended uses. And I think this is the what the public has to rely on, is the performance of the federal agency that has been established to maintain an order in this marketplace.
Well, if we are being misled in any way by the various products that are on the market, there has to be a guilty party, am I right?
You mean the pharmaceutical industry?
Right. Is it the industry, or is it the physician, or the manufacturers of these products?
Well, I think that the problem must be shared. I think to a certain extent it is a problem with the manufacturers. I think that the regulatory laws are never passed for absolutely honest people. We have found some evidence in our investigations of situations in which manufacturers have been less than honest in providing information to the Food and Drug Administration. We found that the Food and Drug Administration has in itself not always been on its toes and alert to situations. We find that physicians appear frequently not to be aware of the newest developments with respect to drugs. They're very busy people. We realize that. So I think that it's a... And then we know there are instances in which pharmacists make errors in dispensing. So I think it would be difficult to lay the blame entirely at any one doorstep.
Does the Food and Drug Administration have laws, or not the laws, but the enforcement that you are charged with? Is it strong enough to correct these wrongs in the industry?
I believe that basically the Food and Drug Administration does have the necessary legislative authority in the wake of the thalidomide disaster, which you mentioned in your opening remarks. The Congress did extensively amend the food and drug laws, and I believe that we probably have as strong drug laws as any country in the world. I think it's a matter of making those laws work, and I don't believe up to this point they have worked as the Congress intended them to work.
How do physicians learn about the tremendous number of new drugs that comes on the market?
Well, there are a number of ways that they may learn about them. There have been some surveys done, public opinion type surveys, marketing surveys, many of them sponsored by the drug industry, which indicate that the single most important source of information about prescription drugs for the physician is the company detail men, as they're called. These are the company's salesmen who call on physicians in their offices and tell them about the company's products and try to sell them to them, or to convince them that they should prescribe their particular company's product. There are other areas. There are the medical journals, which have two sources of information. One is the articles in medical journals, and the other, of course, is the drug ads that are carried in medical journals and which account for a large part of the revenue of some of those journals.
Is there any subtle form of bribery that is used in asking doctors to use certain drugs? And I'm not trying to put all physicians in the country on trial by that statement, but I'm just curious.
Well, one recent example that got into the news was the students at the Harvard Medical School who had traditionally received in their senior year, I think, or somewhere along there, on the line a free stethoscope from a large manufacturing company, and they all returned them this time. I think that occasionally these things do happen. Certain reference book, physician's desk reference, which is a listing of drugs paid for by the manufacturers. Some manufacturers buy up large volumes of this as a listing of drugs with information about them, and send these out to physicians. So I don't think there's any question that the companies in the industry are always trying to stay on the good side of doctors.
Do doctors make any money from the prescriptions that are given to patients?
Well, they're not supposed to, according to the ethics of the American Medical Association. I'm not aware, if you're talking about a kickback from the pharmacy, I suppose there have been instances in the past. I don't know of any offhand. There have been some inquiries. Senator Hart, for example, had some investigations a couple of years ago on physician-owned pharmacies and has introduced some legislation to prevent physicians from owning pharmacies and then prescribing drugs, or owning drug packaging, repackaging companies. There's another example where they would buy drug in bulk and repackage it under a different name, a different label. But I don't believe you would find much this day of physicians getting a kickback from a pharmacy, say, sending business to that particular pharmacy.
Well, I was always been curious as to when you're given a prescription by a doctor and he can prescribe the proper medicines for you, but you never know how much it's going to cost you until you go to the drugstore, and the pharmacist will look at it, and if you ask him, well, approximately, what do you think it'll be? And he'll say, well, $8, $10, $12 just by looking at it. And conceiving so many drugs, I've often admired the tremendous recall that they have, that they can just look at a prescription and be able to tell you almost immediately how much it'll cost.
Well, I think there are a number of factors involved in different pharmacies price in different ways. Some operate on a cost-plus-fee basis for filling a prescription. Others operate on a markup basis where they mark up a certain percentage of the original cost of the drug to them. And then there are discount drug stores. And so I think this makes for different prices at different drug stores of the same drug. There was one rather interesting study that was done, I believe, in Kansas City a couple of years ago. They had students from medical school, and they found who went out with armed with prescriptions into pharmacies in different areas, and they had some Negro medical students and some white medical students, and they dressed the Negro medical students very poorly and the white medical students very nicely, and sent them to pharmacies in different neighborhoods, and then they switched them around, and they found out ironically that the Negro students were frequently charged more than the white students. And that particularly in low-income areas, they were charged more.
But this doesn't seem to be much different than the price of food in most black areas, which is generally higher than you find in other areas.
Yes, I think that some of those studies have been done also. This is the only one I happen to know of that was done in the area of drugs, prescription drugs in particular. But it did work out that way in that particular case.
Now, this drug, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, Panalba, is that correct?
Yes, Panalba. Right.
Now, it's one of 200 drugs most often prescribed, and with sales totaling, according to our research, some $20 million a year. Now, this drug has been found to be a serious hazard to patients. Now, why did it take such a long period for the patients to find out that it was hazardous, so the people were involved in this?
Well, let me put it this way. There are no drugs that are absolutely safe. And to put the Panalba matter in perspective, it is a combination of two antibiotics, tetracycline and novobiocin, each of which is available on the market separately. And they have a different range of activity. They're for different types of infective organisms, and they each have their own particular side effects. Now, what the National Academy said with respect to Pan Alba was that there was no justification for putting this drug out in a fixed dosage combination, so much of tetracycline, so much novaliacin, because the patient only has one infection. And one or the other of those drugs might be indicated, but not both. So the patient is getting one drug that he doesn't need, and that drug may cause a very serious side effect.
This is Night Call in New York, and our conversation tonight is the high cost of health, and we'll be talking about a number of things, including aspirins and tranquilizers and other pills, and we certainly hope that we will receive your call. Our guest tonight calling in from Washington, D.C. is Mr. W. Donald Gray. He's the chief counsel and investigator for the subcommittee in Washington. We return to our guest following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Mr. Donald Gray after station identification.
What do I really want? Well, the same things any man wants, black or white. I want a decent job. The same chance as any man to better myself, to get ahead. I want a home my wife won't be ashamed of. I want our kids to grow up as proud of being black as of being American. I want to be able to give them what they want, and maybe a little extra. If I don't get all the things I want, it should be because I failed, pure and simple, not because I'm black. I want nothing more than anyone else, but nothing less either.
It isn't easy to get by in the city these days, for blacks or whites. Our cities need help, your help. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder. Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York. Speak for yourself from anywhere in North America to guest legal advisor Donald Gray about the drug industry in America. Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
Mr. Gray, the drug industry spends in excess of $800 million a year on advertising, and that seems a lot of money to spend on advertising. How is it possible that the industry consistently is accused of misleading advertising when you think in terms of the tremendous amount of money that's being expended?
Well, until 1962, there was no provision in the law to deal with deceptive or misleading advertising of prescription drugs. Since that time, the Food and Drug Administration has had this authority, but have been very thinly staffed in that area. And with the number of medical journals, various direct mail promotions, film strips, films, various other things that are used to try to influence physicians. And mind you, this large sum you mentioned is being used utilized in the case of prescription drugs to influence 200,000 to 300,000 physicians, not the general public. And so there has been a difficulty, and I think you can see it's impossible for small staff in the Food and Drug Administration to scan and read all of this material. So they've had to rely to a large extent on complaints that have come in and whatever scanning they could do. So on. And they've had to find their way here. There are some new regulations that I believe will be going into effect shortly to spell out in more detail what is and is not permissible in the advertising of prescription drugs.
This is Night Call in New York. We'll take our first call of the evening from New York, a local call. Mr. Allen is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. Allen?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Yeah, I was just...
Would you turn your radio down, Mr. Allen, please?
All right.
Thank you.
Just one minute. was trying to say is that I purchased quite a bit of drugs at the store right here on the corner where I stay. And I find out that the prices are a little bit higher here than they are in other places. And I just wondering why here in Beth Stuyvesant the place prices are higher here than they are in other places. And you can go to some drug stores and get the same thing for a different price, 50 cents or a quarter cheaper.
Right. Well, this is something I mentioned earlier. Pharmacies do use different markup prices or different prices for arriving at a retail price. There are some that will charge a fixed fee for each prescription, $1, $2, plus the actual cost of the drug to them. There are others that take the cost of the drug and mark it up by a certain percentage. They may vary from one store to another. And then there are other stores that have a 10 or 20% discount price off the suggested retail, say. And so this can account for differences. And then I did mention there was the one study done by medical school which indicated that in that particular study, prices in low-income areas, and particularly to Negro medical students, were higher than the prices that their white medical students found.
Yeah, well, this is what I find in this community. For the simple reason, see, I work in a certain part of Manhattan, and I can purchase the same thing. See, my daughter suffers from asthma, and I can purchase the same thing there for something like $2.95, and I come over here and it costs me $5.95.
Right.
And that's a complete $2 difference.
That's right. And there is no regulation by the government, of course, of those prices. So you're almost in a position of having to try to find the pharmacy where you get the best buy on the same drug. Of course, there are, in some cases, it's been demonstrated in hearings before the Congress, that there are sometimes differences in prices depending on whether you get a brand from one manufacturer or from another manufacturer of what is basically the same drug.
Well, I just want to ask you just one more question. Do the people on Medicaid, Medicare pay the same amount as we pay?
I don't believe that they do at the moment. I really can't answer. I know that there has been an effort in the works to establish some basis for determining the Medicare, Medicaid prescription price that the government will have to reimburse, and it has been taking the lines of cost plus a fee. And I'm not sure whether anything definitive has been done along that line yet or not, but I think maybe in some states they've taken some action. I'm not sure that there's a national policy on that at the moment.
Mr. Allen, thank you for calling, sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Out to Bloomington, Indiana, Mr. Mason is hearing Night Call over WFIU. Mr. Mason?
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
I have a question I'd like to ask Mr. Gray.
He's on the line, sir.
Great. Let's say about 3 or 4 years ago, I read this book by the late Senator Estes Keefe, Father, Monopoly Power in America, and on his chapter on the drug industry, you mentioned this earlier in your introductory discussion about economic ties between the physician and distribution facilities, specifically the drug stores. And he had documented evidence where there were several physicians in this particular study who not only, you know, were just linked, say, you know, as far as the kickback was concerned, but who actually owned these drug stores that they would refer you to if you got a prescription from them.
Right.
And I don't know, you know, you said this was a violation of the American Medical Association's ethics.
Yes.
But is this as pervasive today as it was when Senator Kefauver was doing the study?
Well, it's hard to say. I can only answer that Senator Kefauver's successor, Senator Hart, on that same subcommittee, since Senator Kefauver's death, has done some further study in the area of physician-owned pharmacies and drug packaging relabeling plants. And he does have some legislation which he's introduced, but it has not been passed by Congress. He also fed into it, as a result of some further investigation, the dispensing of eyeglasses by ophthalmologists, for example. I'm afraid I couldn't say the extent to which this is going on in the present time.
What about in the course of your investigation, the numbers, you know, the frequency of this occurring?
Well, I would have to say that, our particular subcommittee has not been involved in that phase of the investigation. Our concern has been more with the safety and effectiveness of drugs and how the Food and Drug Administration is performing its responsibilities to assure safety and effectiveness than it has in these economic areas, which other committees, such as Senator Kefauver's and Senator Hart's and Senator Nelson's, very notably, have been concerned with, because their jurisdiction goes more into the economic and competitive aspects of the industry.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Out to Brooklyn, New York, Miss Martin is hearing Night Call over WLIBFM. Miss Martin?
Yes.
Good evening, ma'am.
Yes. In reference to the gentleman's statement just previous to my call, I'm particularly concerned about the pill, you know. And I work with a group of women, some of whom have been on it and some of whom have not. And we're reading various magazine articles, and one says the pill is great, another says that you can get thrombosis, and others says that women can die from using it. And the gentleman says that the concern of the FDA is the safety and effectiveness of the drugs that are put on the market for consumers. And I'm just wondering how the pill could have been released, and, you know, like, I take it, and I'm concerned about, I have a lot of conflicts about it, but that's beside the point. I'm just wondering how it could have been released without some definite information. Well, is it really dangerous, or, you know, will women really have serious side effects, or are the side effects minimized, or what have you?
Right. Well, there are several aspects to that. One is that the first birth control pill came on the market, I believe, about 1960, prior to the drug amendments of 1962, which considerably strengthened the Food and Drug Administration's authority in this area. Secondly, so far as I can determine, and I've been following this one for a long time, there has never been much question about the effectiveness of the pill. It's considered a very effective means of contraception. It has turned basically on the safety. And I think it's now pretty generally recognized that the drug was allowed on the market with rather skimpy evidence in terms of the numbers of patients involved, the length of time they'd been studied, and the kinds of tests that had been done, and so on. It immediately became a very widely used product. And the Food and Drug Administration, in enforcing the law, takes the posture that there is no such thing as absolute safety. Any drug might have side effects in certain people or at certain dosages and so on. And what they attempt to do is to balance the good, potential good of the drug against its potential for harm. Now, in that respect, what they have done, they have left the pill on the market, even though new evidence that's been coming in since they originally came on the market have been shown increasing evidence of rather serious toxicity with the birth control pills. And the labeling has been progressively restricted over the years to warn of these possible side effects, such as the blood clotting problems and other serious problems, and to say that the pill is not to be used in women with certain kinds of medical histories because they seem to be more prone to be subject to those side effects and so on. In other words, they've tried to do it through progressive restrictions in the labeling, hoping that the message would get through to physicians.
Mr. Gray, when you make the statement that no drug is completely safe, this poses another question. When a new drug is introduced, does the Food and Drug Administration or any other agency have to approve of the drug before it's marketed?
Yes, the Food and Drug Administration does have to approve any drug before it goes on the market.
So, well, that precisely was my question. How could it have been approved if there were questions concerning it?
Well, as I say.
Yeah, and not concerning, but we know that it's effective.
I think that the problem was not that they knew about the side effects of the drug in 1960, but that it had been studied in so few people and for such short periods of time that these side effects had not become apparent. In other words, before a drug is put on the market, it is studied in animals and in a certain number of humans under experimental conditions. Now,
would this indicate that there wasn't sufficient time allotted for the proper investigation of the pill?
Well, that's I think a factor here, because prior to the 62 amendments, the Food and Drug Administration, I believe, had to act on an application within 90 days after it was submitted. Otherwise, it automatically became effective. The 62 amendments turned that around so that no drug is automatically approved after a lapse of time now. They have to get affirmative approval from the Food and Drug Administration. Now, I think the problem arises out of the quality of the research that is done before a drug is allowed to go on the market. And even with the best design of research involving giving drugs, say, to two groups of people, one would get the drug under test and the other might get a placebo or dummy pill or some other known effective drug for that particular condition, and neither the investigator nor the patient would know which was getting the real drug and which was getting the placebo or dummy pill. And then you give it for a certain period of time, and then you measure, make certain tests to measure the results, and then you analyze it statistically and see if there's significant differences between the two groups.
Mr. Gray, I'm going to ask you to hold. We have to break for station identification. Thank you so much for calling, Ms. Martin.
Thank you.
This is Night Call in New York. We return to our guest, Mr. W. Donald Gray, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Mr. Donald Gray after station identification.
If you left school and you're between 16 and 22, Job Corps wants to give you a chance to start again, a chance to learn the skills that can help you get a good job. Maybe as an auto mechanic, an office worker, a welder, just about anything. And while you're learning, you'll be living at a Job Corps center. You'll get free medical and dental care, clean clothes, your own bed to sleep in, and three square meals a day. Job Corps will even pay you while you're learning. See your state employment office, or write Job Corps, Washington, D.C. Job Corps will give you a chance, just for once. Give yourself a chance.
Speak for yourself from anywhere in North America to guest legal advisor Donald Gray about the drug industry in America. Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
Out to Seattle, Washington, Mrs. Martin is hearing Night Call over KUOW. Mrs. Martin?
Good evening, Del.
Good evening.
This is a wonderful program. We certainly enjoy listening to you as often as we can.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'd like to ask Mr. Gray if he'd comment on generic drugs. Does he think that a patient should ask a doctor to prescribe the generic drug? And might this be a way for a person to keep his drug costs down?
Well, I think that it probably is a way of keeping the drug costs down. As you perhaps know, there's a great deal of controversy and has raged over the last few years around the question of whether generic drugs are as good as the brand name drugs. I think there's a great deal of misunderstanding in the whole area. I think it is true, and there have been studies illustrating that the same drug put out by two different manufacturers may produce some differences in terms of the amount of drug that would show up in the blood if you did a blood test at certain stated intervals after giving the same dosage of the two drugs, which has been demonstrated. What's missing, I think, in this whole puzzle is whether a slightly lower blood level of one drug means that it will not have the same effect as another drug that produces a different blood level. I think what tended to happen is that the first drug that gets on the market is taken to be the standard. It's been assumed that anything that produces less of the drug in the blood, you know, may not be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that nearly enough research has been done in this area to verify that. I think the only way it can ever be settled in particular cases is to take patients who have a given medical problem and give them, divide them into groups and give them the drug that the various type of brands of the same drug that are indicated for that condition, measure the blood levels, and at the same time do other tests to determine whether they really get better or not. And then you can get some baseline, I think, from which to make that determination. But it's a very controversial area at the moment. Another side of the thing that has not been discussed as frequently is that a higher blood level, if it's not really required to treat a particular medical disorder, may also cause the side effects mm-hmm. to be greater. So I think that there's a great deal more research that needs to be done in this area before one can conclude whether they are clinically equivalent or not. But I think on the economic side, which you asked about, there have been many studies which indicate that, generally speaking, generic drugs do sell much less than brand name products.
Thank you for calling, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Out to Indianapolis, Indiana, Mrs. Curry is hearing that call over WFBN. Mrs. Curry?
Yes?
Good evening, ma'am.
Well, I don't know how to approach you on the subject at all, but could there be a way that doctors could give the wrong drug to anybody?
Is it possible for the doctors to give the wrong drug?
By giving the wrong drug, do you mean giving a drug that they do not intend to give?
In the menopause or anything like that?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by giving the wrong drug. If you mean that he might intend to give you a particular drug, and the drug that you get from the pharmacy is actually a different one from the one he intended, I think that's possible. Poor handwriting on a prescription or misunderstanding on a telephone prescription, something of that nature, I think a drug other than the one that the doctor intends can be given. It's also possible that the physician could make an error himself and prescribe something that he doesn't intend to prescribe.
Not hormones, but tranquilizers for
yes.
nerves that are too severe for anybody.
Well, it is possible. There are differences, of course, in age, for example. There are some of the tranquilizers.
How about a 40-year-old person that is on tranquilizers and...
Right.
I'm not talking for myself. I'm talking for a dear person near to my heart.
An older person?
40 years old.
40. Well, that certainly wouldn't be a geriatric patient, where some tranquilizers, a lesser dose is recommended for older patients. I'm not sure I understand exactly what you mean by prescribing
well,
the wrong drug.
Is,
it may be that the physician is not familiar.
Could you go to the wrong resource for her search for something?
I beg your pardon?
Could she be going to somebody that... She's searching for something, perhaps. Maybe it could be psychiatry, but they have her on tranquilizers, and they aren't changing them. I understand. am I right, that they should be changed every so often? You can't stay on one.
Well, there is a possibility that if you stay on the same drug over a long period of time, you may, you know, it may have a buildup of that drug in the body, which would cause a side effect over a period of time that would not show up when it was first given.
Well, why would she want to just go away and just be alone? And,
well, I think it's a difficult area when you talk about the tranquilizers and the antidepressants and the other drugs that are used in psychiatric medicine. Frequently, patients receiving these drugs are either over-anxious or depressed, you know, already.
She's a very happy person and meets the public just beautifully.
Well, if it's possible that you feel that the physician who is treating the patient is not giving her the kind of advice or the kind of treatment that you feel is proper, why not have her to switch to another doctor?
Well, that's what I was inquiring about. Because
I'm afraid that's really about the only alternative you have in that kind of situation. If you have reason to believe your physician is not helping you, I think, you know, you have to get a second opinion.
Mrs. Curry, thank you so much for calling, ma'am.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gray, we read a great deal about aspirins and diet pills and vitamins, and it seems that these three particular items gross a great deal of money. And a lot of people will say, well, the vitamins really aren't doing what they're supposed to do, and the diet pills don't do what they're supposed to do, and we've got, I don't know how many different kinds of aspirins on the market. But in these three items, do we find the American public being taken advantage of in terms of cost, as well as in terms of what the promises are, that what these items can do?
Well, there's certainly wide ranges in prices on, say, vitamin formulations that are available on the market. I think the key question is whether people routinely need vitamins and minerals and iron preparations and so on or not. The Food and Drug Administration has taken a very strong position. They're involved in some extensive hearings on the subject now to try to cut down on the promotion of these dietary products, vitamins and minerals and so on the grounds that people with a normal diet, without a medical problem that causes a deficiency of any of the essential vitamins and minerals, don't need to take them. And that if you do have such a medical problem or deficiency, as a layman, you're not capable of diagnosing it. You really need to go to a physician, lay run proper tests to find out what you need.
Mrs. Bard is hearing Night Call from Olympia, Washington. She's hearing Night Call over KUOW. Mrs. Bard?
Yes. Good evening.
Good evening, ma'am.
And you know what I would like to say? I have for many years, 10, 12, 15 years, I've been taking drugs and I've spent endless amounts of money. And I have taken them because, well, the particular problem was rheumatoid arthritis. And I took cortisone and that gave me osteoporosis. And I took chloroquine that almost made me blind. I tried Triobil and Indocin, and they just didn't agree with me at all. They were very severe headaches. And then lately I had been taking this Pavolate, these glorified aspirin.
Yes.
And they made my stomach sick. And you know what I have finally come to? And I couldn't hear the last program, and I know something was being said about vitamins. But what I found out, I was very deficient in vitamins, and I got a really good dose, and I'm taking a generous proportion, you know, a sensible proportion, and I find I can get along without all these things. And I, you know what I believe, after all these many years of misery, that so many of us, we are undernourished, we don't realize it. And then when you take one medicine, the doctor is quick to prescribe it. And then he prescribes another. And that causes new problems. And I think with most of people, it is the fact that they just undernourished. You know, I mean, all these foods that we get, they don't give you proper nourishment. Don't you think?
Well, I think it depends on each individual person's diet. I think it's possible that a person could have such poor eating habits that he would have deficiency of vitamins and minerals.
It's also
possible there may be some organic problem that causes a deficiency of an essential. I say that I think it depends on the individual's diet, but then there may be also medical problems that cause a deficiency of an essential vitamin or mineral, and they certainly are capable of treatment. I'm not sure that the average person is capable of diagnosing that kind of problem. Maybe sort of hit or miss. You may take a vitamin shotgun vitamin formula that has 10 or 12 vitamins and minerals in it, and something in there may help you. I think in the disease you mentioned, arthritis, it's pretty generally agreed, I believe, that there hasn't been any really satisfactory treatment developed yet.
Yeah.
The National Institute of Arthritis and Metabolic Diseases spends a lot of money every year in research, and the Arthritis Foundation does the same thing, and there have been these drugs that have come along periodically that appeared to offer hope, and almost invariably, over a period of time, the deficiencies have shown up.
Mrs. Bard, I'm sorry, but I have to break for station identification. Thank you for calling.
Yeah.
This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our conversation with Mr. W. Donald Gray is the high cost of health. We'll return following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Mr. Donald Gray after station identification. Listen to the voices of Night Call.
We're trying to bring about change in this nation through nonviolent channels. Now, if we cannot do it through nonviolence, there are other forces that are going to lead people down a violent path, and the nation will be destroyed.
Ralph Abernathy on apathy and violence, and a white industrialist says jobs will save us from a racial inferno.
It's better to learn and earn than to burn, baby, burn. Now, these are the changes in attitude that spring from the community as a whole to try to work with these people, not just work on them, and to have industry reach into the area and try to recruit and hire the guy that's qualified and to get the other fellow to take training so he, too, can get a job.
Speak for yourself on Night Call. Speak for yourself from anywhere in North America to guest legal advisor Donald Gray about the drug industry in America. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Again, Dell Shields.
Mr. Gray, when we find that the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association represents some 135 of the largest drug manufacturers in the country, and I guess we can assume that these companies kind of enjoy a degree of monopoly, since I understand that they manufacture some 95% of the drugs on the marketplace today.
Right.
Can we assume that these manufacturers are sincerely interested in the American public, or is it a pure dollars and cents operation?
Well, I think it's always a little bit dangerous to characterize everybody, you know, the same. I think they do have a great concern about their profit picture. It has habitually, in recent years, been, I think, the second most profitable industry after the auto industry in this country. The current commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, in a speech that he prepared for their annual meeting earlier, I believe the end of last month, did say some rather strong things about the industry and its concern. He said that that the industry is concerned about its image, that it can rightfully boast of great achievements, but it must never forget its responsibilities, and has the responsibility of the health of every American. He says, but I feel very strongly that you're in a grave danger of losing public confidence unless there's a major change in the drug industry's emphasis on sales over safety. The industry as we know it today may well be buried within the next several years in a grave that has helped to dig inch by inch, over-promotion by over-promotion, bad drug by bad drug. That's a quote from Commissioner Lay's recent speech. So apparently he feels there's some over-concern with the profit picture and that it is, in some instances, clouded the concern for the patient.
Is the market glutted today with ineffective drugs?
Well, it's hard to say. The effectiveness provisions were not added to the law until 1962, from 1938 until 1962. In order to get on the market, the manufacturer only had to submit evidence of the drug's safety. In 1962, the Congress passed the amendment that said from that time forward, any drug, in order to get on the market, would also have to be proven by adequate and well-controlled medical studies to be effective. They also said that all of those drugs that had come on between 1938 and 1962 on grounds of safety alone would then have to be shown to be effective. That was 7 years ago, and relatively little has been accomplished in that area, I think, up to the present time. We recently went into this in great detail in some of our hearings. There are a number of factors involved, I think. Chairman of our subcommittee, Congressman Fountain, offered the opinion that there'd been sort of a do-nothing attitude in FDA for a certain period of time, and then in 1966, former Commissioner Goddard brought the National Academy of Sciences into the picture because FDA did not have the medical and other scientific resources apparently to do the job. They've been engaged in a review of this group of about 3,000 drugs that came on the market in between 1938 and 1962 without having been proven effective. The Pan Alba situation, which you mentioned, is one result of that. Just this week, another order was published by Food and Drug Administration proposing to take the same action with respect to 48 other antibiotic combinations as they proposed to take with respect to Pan Alba. But still, there, I think, including all of those, there's still something less than 200 of the total of 3,000 that the Academy, National Academy experts have reviewed, that the Food and Drug Administration has taken action on with respect to their status on the market.
Well, John Kenneth Galbraith suggested a few days ago when he was in Washington in terms of the defense industries that perhaps it was necessary for the defense industries to be nationalized. And I was wondering that since we're talking about drugs and we are concerned with the health of millions of American people, would it be best for the drug industry to become nationalized to ensure that the health of the American people will always be safeguarded?
I don't really believe that is the solution. It would be a very radical departure, but I believe that the situation is one where we have the authority, the legislative authority, to make the system work. The Food and Drug Administration is armed with the legal authority that it needs. I think it has to make up its mind that the Congress intended the food and drug laws to be enforced as they are written, fairly and equitably, but across the board, and to come to the Congress and tell us what they really need to do the job and to get on about it. One of the things that came out very strongly in these recent hearings on effectiveness was that the Food and Drug Administration, despite its problems in terms of resources, has not made the best use of its resources at times. And they're not, instead of taking action as the law authorizes them to do on removing drugs that the Academy experts have found have not been proven effective, instead they're saying publishing orders in many cases saying, well, unless you come up with some new information within 6 months or a year or something to that effect, then we'll have to take it off the market. Well, you know, during that year, new information may be submitted. It may not be any better than what the Academy's already reviewed, and it may take another year to get that information reviewed. And you could be 2 years from now, you know, the same problem, the drug's still on the market, people still paying their money for it. So I think the answer is for the Food and Drug Administration to really start to enforce the law as it's written and to gear itself up to do the job they have to do.
Let's go out to Indianapolis, Indiana. Mrs. Kennedy is hearing Night Call over WFBM. Mrs. Kennedy?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening. It's nice to hear your program, and I enjoy it so much.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
I have a couple of questions I'd like to pose. I wonder what his conception is on this business of the abuse of the use of the medicine for women.
Wait, would you speak up, ma'am, please?
I didn't catch the last part.
Women that feel the need at a certain age of a lot of medication. You think this is scientific change in their body, and why they feel this? Is it just within their own minds, or is there an actual need, or is it an abuse of it?
Well, I don't think there's any question that there are hypochondriacs in the world. I'm afraid that only the physician who's making the examination and diagnosis can really, you know, make a really educated guess as to whether the person that he's examining is in fact ill or had an imagined ill. But I think you almost have to bear in mind that to the person who has an imagined ill, it's just as real as if it were an actual ill.
Oh, very definitely. Uh-huh, very definitely.
And I think the physician then has to make the determination of whether it's something with which he can cope, or if he feels it's not a real medical, physical problem, then to see if he can get the patient the kind of assistance that might help solve whatever imagined ills it might be.
Yes, yes. Now, in this score, I think we find a lot of use of a lot of nerve medicine given.
Tranquilizers.
Yes, that's quite true.
Mrs. Kennedy, I'm sorry, but time has run out on us. Thank you so much for calling now.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Gray, just we have about 20 seconds, and if you could give us like kind of a short answer. Do you feel that the American public is being victimized by the drug industry? Are we safe or unsafe?
I think that there has been some misplaced faith. I think there's been a tendency to assume that the Food and Drug Administration is in Washington and that all is well with the world, and my experience would indicate that is not necessarily true.
Mr. Gray, I'm sorry, sir, but time has run out on us. Thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call.
Right.
This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Are black studies simply an excuse for academic jingoism and collegiate black separation, or are they, both for blacks and for whites, a legitimate academic involvement with long-neglected area of American history and culture? What do black studies mean with Dr. Roy Bryce LaPointe? Listen Monday night, discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.